Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Valley Roundup. Joining me today are Jason Auslander, reporter with the Aspen Times. Jason, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Andre Saville, reporter with the Aspen Daily News. Hi, Andre.
Howdy.
And Aspen Public Radio's reporter, Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Jason, I'm going to come right to you first. You had a story this week about a video that an alleged sexual assault victim has posted online, which is after days that we were hearing about the two men who are being held for this. And you're not naming one of the defendants because he's underage. So is the victim. And she named him in this video. So there's a lot going on there just with kind of newspaper ethics and rules about reporting on crimes. Can you just brief us on your story. So what happened this week? What did she post?
Well, she posted a video late last week, I believe on Thursday, maybe 24 hours, a little further than that, after those two guys were arrested. And, you know, it's titled, "I Will Not Be Silenced." It has her name there, Paige Quist, and she posted it on YouTube. And I looked at it, and it was, you know, powerful stuff. And so I ended up getting a hold of her, and I interviewed her and said, you know, are you sure that you want this? Are you okay with us linking the video? And she said, yeah. And I said, please make sure your mother calls me. So I spoke with her mom, and her mom was fully supportive. We had, of course, that discussion about the name that's in there, that because she identifies him. Yeah, it's kind of one of those borderline issues. He has been charged as an adult.
Okay.
At this point, he's 17 years old. And in a case like this, you know, after they're charged as an adult, I think it's fair game to be named in the newspaper. However, his lawyer, while he has not done so yet, says he's going to file a motion to try and kick the case back to juvenile court. So that's going to be up to Judge Chris Selden to determine that. Again, that motion hasn't been filed yet, so it's hard to say when that decision might be made. I think there's a good chance that we will name him in the paper if the judge supports keeping it in adult court.
One thing that your story points out, and I think her video a little bit, is that this brings the hashtag MeToo movement to the Valley. And part of this coverage just, I think, helps us understand that some of the national conversation about sexual assault, about victims and how they're treated when they come forward, that isn't a faraway conversation. The one thing this story does is just show this happens everywhere, including our home.
Right. This particular issue here, I think, is going to turn out, as they've sort of insinuated, that there's other cases. Mm-hmm. And once they're, you know, ready to talk about that, I think that this is going to become a much larger thing, is my sense of it. You know, that said, it's bringing that here close to home. And I think once the details are known, I think it's going to be it's going to hit like a sledgehammer.
Andre, do you have thoughts on, this is an underage girl. She's 17. She's put it out there. Is it right for the media to then continue to spread her story?
She's 16.
She's 16. Yeah. Thank you.
I think so. She's already come out on a video. It's very public. I'm sure everyone associated with the local public schools has mm-hmm. watched the video. She wants to tell her story. And I don't see a problem with that.
How many hits were there when you first saw it, Jason?
There were 200, just over 200 when I saw it. And then when I checked it yesterday morning, there were over 500, which still isn't a ton. But the one thing that I have gotten feedback from, and I don't tend to get a lot, but on this one, a woman emailed me yesterday morning and said, you know, great story. I sent it to both of my daughters. Thank you for writing it. And, you know, she wanted to, the link to the video wasn't working at the time. She was like, can you fix that? And we did. But, you know, I think that the time to be quiet about this stuff is over. You know, and hopefully that and mental illness are coming into the national discussion, the national consciousness now as serious issues that need to be, you know, dealt with. And, you know, for guys like me who don't sexually harass or abuse women, it's been a real eye opener in how abusive and oppressive it must be to be a woman in this society.
You know, I checked the video this morning. There's 1,700 hits on it now.
Really?
And we've been talking, Elizabeth, about the social media aspect of what would be maybe a slightly more concentrated or at least slightly more controlled judicial process.
Right. It does feel like there's a shift maybe in how much information the public has ahead of the justice system taking a look at these things. And I think it is, there are some things that it makes me question. She's young, you know, she's 16, and the title, I Will Not Be Silenced, is really powerful. We also, I think, speak, like, I used to be a teacher, so there's a sense of, like, protection of kids who are under 18 in certain circumstances that just says, like, hey, let's, like, press the pause button here. And I wonder about the focus that this puts again on victims to have to speak up, or on, and the girl, the student in the video makes a case for, like, if you want to talk, I'm here to talk. It feels very much like she's reaching out in a way to say, you don't have to be alone, and I'm making this choice because that's what I want. It makes me hurt that it feels like for her, that's the step that has to happen.
Well, and I think also that I talked with her mother, and this is based on my observations of her as well as speaking with her mother in this. And, you know, if you see the end of that video, she talks about some of the things that she's gone through in the last couple months, which we stayed away from specifically in the print. So initially that was her reaction to it. And her mother was like, but she's found her voice. She feels empowered by this. And I think that's important. And she's 16. And yes, maybe she'll regret this when she's 24, but maybe not.
Well, right. And I think it is interesting because the Me Too movement, what we've seen so far with the Me Too movement is people looking back on their past. Like, it has been a reflective kind of a movement, I think, where people say, yeah, this happened to me when I was young, but it tends to be not as immediate in the moment.
And another thing I want to point out too is that if you've obviously watched the video, she's very careful not to go into specifics, and that was at the request of the prosecutor. And the prosecutor asked her, in talking to me, and her mother reiterated this to me as well, to not get into those specifics because of evidentiary issues.
Well, how does this affect the trial aspect, though, anyway? Will this case be tried in Picking County now that the coverage is here and the video is here?
It's a good question, and I think that that will probably come up. However, in my experience covering the criminal justice system for 25 years, jury pollution is just a whole lot of hooey from defense lawyers most of the time.
That's interesting.
98% of the time.
So I want to shift this into our upcoming election for Picking County Sheriff, because there's a connection. One of the people who is the alleged offender in this case has been brought up before, at least to the man who's running to unseat Picking County Sheriff Joe DeSalvo, Walter Chi, who he heard that this man has been involved in some criminal sexual activity in the past, or there's claims or an investigation that he heard this.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and it did come up at Squirm Night a question to the sheriff's candidate, Walter Chi. He advised, I guess, the grandmother, or she sought his advice some years ago concerning that case. Allegedly involved the perpetrator in the second case, which we've been discussing the last few minutes. And then the sheriff, Joe DeSalvo, made a point of connecting the dots at Squirm Night between the two cases, and
Was that appropriate? Would we have known that connection if he hadn't brought that up in the debate?
No. No. But I don't think it would have been far below the surface. You know, I mean, I think there were some groans in the room that he did that from. But I think the implication, and I wasn't at Squirm Night, maybe you can, the implication being that had Walter reported it, possibly this latest thing might not have happened. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, who's to say that, you know, it wouldn't have happened? You know, it's, I'm not saying that Joe did that for political purposes or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that. But he did bring it up at Squirm Night. It was the, I guess if you want to say it was the highlight of Squirm Night, you could say that. But it's, you know, and Walter, frankly, I don't know that he's handled the situation all that well, given that, you know, he says he knows about mandatory reporting and the rules, but he didn't report it. He said that he didn't know that the incident was of a sexual or child sexual assault nature or something like that. And then, but it came out in the police report that he brought up River Bridge, the River Bridge facility.
Right.
And Joe made a point of that at Squirm Night to talk about, well, River Bridge is only an agency or whatever that deals with child sex cases.
Well, and the other thing is that in that police report, the very few details that we have about any of these is that the grandmother walked in and the kid was 15, I think, at the time. His pants were down.
Mm-hmm.
Around his knees, and that's the one detail that we do have. But if that's the one detail she shared, you know, it brings up some questions.
It brings up a lot of questions, and I mean, frankly, Walter Chi, decorated 26-year veteran of the Aspen Police Department, has been taken to task over this. And I mean, you could make a case, rightly or wrongly, but politically, it doesn't help his cause in the election. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty apparent.
Was there some sort of question as to why he's running anyway? Like, what's not working right now? Why would someone challenge the incumbent who is a 8-year incumbent?
Well, that's a good question because, I mean, let's face it, Joe DeSalvo is a very popular sheriff. And he wasn't even opposed 4 years ago. He's part of that legacy or whatever you want to call it of mm-hmm. going from Keenis to Bob Broaddus and then now him. I've talked with Walter and interviewed him and done a few stories on the sheriff's race, and my sense is he would like to be sheriff. He's kind of winding toward the end of his career, you know, and I mean he's probably, if not eligible for retirement from the APD, he's close to it, and
I think he's going to retire soon.
He wants to do something else. Yeah, I mean, you may have written that before. I think part of it might be that he just didn't want to see the sheriff go unopposed. I mean, that's just my gut feeling. He didn't say that, and that he would run the sheriff's department in a different way.
It sounds like a little more strict as far as pot, alcohol, those type of laws.
I think he would. I think it's fair to say that he'd move it a bit further to the right. I mean,
and he said that in a story that you did a few last year or mm-hmm. something
when he first announced.
One thing that came up during Squirm Night that I didn't, I would love to learn more about. I don't know if either one of you are looking into this. Is in two different instances, Sheriff DeSalvo talked about the department essentially being underfunded, which I think is really interesting. So one comment he made was, "We don't have the money to train a new sheriff," which for an elected position that has no term limits seems like that he could fall back on that excuse every 4 years if that's the case. Like,
right.
Shouldn't we have the funds so that on any given day we can hire a new sheriff? What if something happens?
I don't know. I think that's pretty weak. I think on-the-job training is the same for all of us. And, you know, yeah, there are things that you're going to learn, but I think that's kind of a...
Some of that's just political rhetoric.
Yeah.
And sheriffs are always going to say they need more money.
Yeah. Right. Well, then it also came up that we only have one deputy on duty during this 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. shift. And he said, yeah, I could put someone else on if I had the money. So again, like the message I got, if you're going to, from that squirm night, is it doesn't sound like we have enough money in the sheriff's department.
Again, they're always going to say they need more money, and in some areas they probably do need more money for, you know, to upgrade the jail and, you know, build new wings for, this is something going on in other counties. The sheriffs say they need to build more facilities to hold mental health patients and things like that.
Or juveniles.
Well, and you know, also if Joe, Ron, and Alex thought that there was a real need to post somebody from 3 a.m. to 7 a.m., they would do it.
They would do it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about money a little bit more with the sheriff's race. Jason, you had a story about all candidates fundraising so far. And Sheriff DeSalvo has outraised by $10,000 every single other candidate within Pickens County combined.
Yep.
So I'm curious. I mean, obviously that shows a lot of support or a lot of financial support, or it's good to give money to the guy who's going to be your next sheriff.
As Andre said, you know, Joe seems to be a pretty popular sheriff. He's gotten a lot of... You know, there's some Hollywood money in there. There's a lot of seemingly Florida real estate money, some Florida addresses in there. You know, Joe's been around for a long time. He's worked for the sheriff. He was 20 years ago when I worked for the Daily News. Joe was the investigator for Bob. So, you know, he's been there for a long time. He knows everybody.
Does he need $40,000 to beat Walter?
It's a good question.
Probably not.
Is it a sign that a challenge? It's a real challenge?
He's spent 36 of it, according to his report. So he's got about $7,000 left. I don't know what he's going to do with the rest. Maybe throw a big victory party or something. I don't know.
Right, because he has to spend it still on something election related. He can't pocket that or give it to the department or anything like that.
I think it can hold over to his next election.
$12,000 of it has gone to someone named Valerie Ryan. Do we know who that is?
Yeah, that's Undersheriff Ron Ryan's wife who's running the campaign.
Running his campaign. It's just staff time. So right. I'm also curious, I guess, what she's doing for $3,000 a month.
Yeah, I would guess that she's organizing all these fundraising events.
She's paid to get more money. Yeah.
I do find it curious that that Joe is taking Walter as seriously as he's taking him. I mean, you wouldn't be raising this much money and you wouldn't be actively campaigning and going to the farmer's market, whatever, every Saturday. And
well, I think you can't underestimate things. I think that's just fair to say I'm going to take it seriously. And also in deference to Walter. You know, Walter's been around as long as Joe has. Walter's
true.
A good guy. So, you know.
So I guess Joey's taking him seriously as far as his popularity. But politically... I just don't see this race being close.
No, I don't either.
You are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This week I'm joined by Jason Auslander, reporter with the Aspen Times, Andre Savale, reporter with the Aspen Daily News, and Aspen Public Radio reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. We're going to take a break and come right back. Elizabeth, this week the city of Aspen made the final settlements in a lawsuit where they were being sued regarding dams on Maroon and Castle Creeks. What's the agreement? What have we ended on here?
Yeah, so the city of Aspen filed to keep water rights, conditional water rights for storage on Castle and Maroon Creeks, and they faced opposition from 10 different parties and groups. They had reached settlement with most of those, with 9, prior to a few days ago. And they reached agreement with that final party on, I think, October 11th or so. If the judge accepts these stipulations in the diligence filing, then the city has agreed to file a water court application to transfer those rights out of wilderness areas. So they would no longer be asking to store water in wilderness areas. Instead, they could move it to a couple other locations that they've identified that includes the Aspen Golf Course, the Maroon Creek part of the Maroon Creek Golf Course. They bought property in Woody Creek last year, I think, for this purpose specifically, and then also are looking at Cozy Point Ranch and the gravel pit in Woody Creek. And then the other piece of it is that they'll limit the total storage to 8,500 acre feet, which is significantly less than the amount of water that they, than those conditional rights on Castle and Maroon.
That final settlement was with a private
party. Yeah, it was with a property owner, the Larson family. And that was only on the Maroon Creek case. Okay. So Castle Creek had been, all of the parties who filed on the Castle Creek case had come to agreement.
So we've seen these settlement agreements, but they still have to be approved?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. This is the city coming together with the groups opposing them, and then the water court judge has to approve it and say, this is fine. You have shown that you meet the requirements to hold on to these rights, and then you can file to move them.
But that is up in the air. Like, what if the city doesn't find something that will be approved for different storage?
So the first thing that needs to happen is the judge says, okay, fine. Okay. Well, you can hold on to these ones while you file to move them. That will be a separate case. Okay. But the city has agreed in these stipulations, has agreed that if they are unable to move those water rights, then they will not keep them on Castle and Maroon Creeks. So the city is taking a risk that they might actually lose those storage rights altogether.
I'm really curious how they are having this discussion in a year, which is the first year ever that the city of Aspen has gone into water restrictions. I mean,
into stage two restrictions.
Stage two water restrictions. So they've made that case. We're keeping these rights. We don't really want to dam these rivers, but hey, guys, water is going to become scarce. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, we saw that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we're seeing shortages in reservoirs across Colorado. It's a little bit of a sticky subject, because if there's a water shortage, a lot of times municipalities immediately will say, well, that's exactly why we need storage, so that we have a fallback in the event that the creeks are running low. At the same time, if the creeks are running really low and we don't have water necessarily to put in storage, we're looking at some issues too, because those water rights would be pretty junior. There would be a lot of other people who have more senior rights who would be able to pull on that water first. So there's a lot of questions remaining kind of about how this would happen in the future. And I think while the city and the groups who filed in opposition are all celebrating this, there's a lot to be figured out in the future.
Did you speak with some of the opposing parties? Did they just get their way here, or did they have to concede anything?
You know, I think it depends. Well, I'm not totally sure for all. I can't speak for all of them. The ones who are focused on conservation, mm-hmm. so kind of Wilderness Workshop, Trout Unlimited, American Rivers, those groups do feel like this is a straight win.
Great.
I talked to Will Rausch of Wilderness Workshop this morning. He said, you know, like, it's out of wilderness areas, and that's a major positive. And when they look at the spots that the city has proposed to store water, Will says there's significantly fewer ecological impacts in those locations than there would be on Castle and Maroon Creek. So I think that's a positive. There is certainly, I think he's probably withholding a little bit of judgment on like what those final permits might look like, or there may be issues that arise down the road that they haven't really looked into specifically yet. But I think on the surface, it feels like a real win for them to see these moved out of wilderness areas.
I was at the top of North Maroon a couple of weeks ago, and Crater Lake was completely dry.
Oh, yeah, it's like a puddle.
There was nothing.
Oh, really?
It was completely, there was not even any wet parts of it. Like, we were looking right down on it, and I was like, that's Crater Lake? It was pretty crazy.
Let's move to Eagle County. And give them a little bit of attention here on Valley Roundup. There's a ballot measure that those in the Roaring Fork Valley who live in that little sliver of Eagle County will see, and it's asking for more money for Eagle County's open space.
One thing to note about that is that the Eagle County open space money also benefits Pitkin County, because they partner on a lot of projects. There's been some significant land purchases and I guess easement acquisitions, whatever you want to call it, in the Emma area in recent years. And that was done through joint partnerships between Pitkin County and Eagle County Open Space. So if the Eagle County money goes away, then Pickens County loses a vital partner in these open space acquisitions. The other thing I would add is that they were talking, the proponents of the Eagle County tax renewal are talking about eyeing some purchases in the Frying Pan River Valley. And as someone who likes to fish, I can say that's a great idea, you know, because a lot of that riverside property is private property. Whether they actually move forward with that in the next few years, you know, remains to be seen. But that's one way that they are trying to promote the tax.
So Andre just said that we can't lose this money. Is this is voting to not let something sunset?
Yeah, it's a reauthorization of Eagle County's open space program. So it extends a tax that exists now that is in place until 2025, and it extends it to 2040.
Okay.
I think they're asking now as a way to plan for the long term. And like Andre said, in the Frying Pan Valley, the program has identified river access as a key piece of their program. Like when they're looking at acquiring open spaces, they're looking particularly at places that allow more access to rivers and to other federal lands. So if you look at what they've done so far in the Roaring Fork Valley, I think you see that. In Emma, it provides river access. In the Frying Pan, they're saying that they want to provide more access to the Frying Pan. They contributed to Glacier Open Space, which gives access to the Crown, which is primarily BLM land. But so it does provide, you know, some key access points to other kinds of recreation and open space.
Jason, we're going to end on a story that you wrote this week. A culprit basically got their way with the long game 3 years later. Some trees near Hunter Creek apartments had to be cut down because they were poisoned.
Yeah, this was the last of kind of a three-year saga that started when somebody went around with a really toxic chemical that apparently you could only get with a forestry license, like in a permit. Like, this is stuff that you don't mess around with. It's produced by DuPont. It's nasty stuff. It's a herbicide. They poured it at the base of initially about 30 or trees or so, and they then pretty soon after that, in 2015, I think maybe early 2000, I can't remember, 16, somewhere in there, they cut down like 30 of these, quite a few of these trees, but they were hoping that some of these cottonwoods would be able to fight off this stuff. Well, it turns out that the last surviving kind of double trunk cottonwood was not gonna survive. So they cut it down, and yeah, the person who did it got their way, if their way was a clear view of Aspen Mountain from Hunter Creek.
Okay, so it's a criminal investigation. You're not allowed to black market get herbicide and then put it at the trees in your front yard.
Well, you know how people feel about trees in this town. It costs $100,000 just to, you know, remove a tree from your property. So they have a, you know, this town employs a forester. So, you know, he knows every single tree in this entire, in the entire city. Yeah, right? Yeah, he's probably named them.
Well, and it costs a lot of money, but you also can't take down a tree unless you have a very valid reason for it, unless the tree is dead or in the way of some other critical city project. I mean, the language around that is pretty specific.
It's serious. And also, it's, you know, I mean, some would say, so I talked to one of them. I happen to live at Hunter Creek, and this last tree was actually in front of my bedroom window that got taken down. And before you accuse me, I wasn't living there 3 years
again,
ago.
Again, I will say I used to live in that unit, and it wasn't me. In 2016, I was
kind
living
of a guilty
in
Telluride. Conscience. And so the forester did, at the city forester, Ian, did end up telling me, he was a little reluctant at first, but did end up telling me that they did this view plane analysis and that it pointed to buildings 300 or 400 that are on the north side of the parking lot, not those red ones in the middle, that was whose view plane. And if you read some police reports, there's some people that kind of drop dime on others in there, but they could never run it down. I mean, they can't run it down.
Okay,
you know?
So we don't know, we won't know
the person's never going to be caught. It's okay. Just never going to happen.
Okay, but the working theory is that this was a crime committed in order to have a better view of Aspen Mountain from somebody's window.
That's what they think.
You've been listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks to Jason Oslender, reporter with the Aspen Times, Andre Savail, reporter with the Aspen Daily News, and Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy for being here.
Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.